something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
All right, today's episode, we're going to be talking about board games. So the most obvious place to start here is, Joe, what about you? What is your favorite board game? Or what board games are you most nostalgic for?
Well, to have a very conventional answer, I have a lot of fond memories of playing Monopoly as a child. But I was just thinking about how the board games I got most excited about as a kid really had no staying power whatsoever. They weren't games that people would still be talking about or still playing really much 20 years later. I was very interested in games that had a lot of complicated physical apparatus.
Okay.
Like I remember seeing the commercials for Mousetrap, I think the game was, that had all these traps that would fall down on figures. And I was really into that, though I don't know if I ever actually played it.
Well, it was a lot to set up, Mousetrap.
Yeah.
The more recent versions of Mousetrap, by the way, have simplified the setup.
So
it's a lot easier to play. The game itself is still pretty basic, but at least it's not this just box of junk that has to be assembled.
Well, another example I remember being super excited about but never actually playing was I took a class when I – not took. I was in a class when I was in elementary school. It was a computer class. And it was one of those cases where they tried to make it cool by gamifying the class. So if you did good things in the class, you get points and you could spend those on prizes, like it's Chuck E. Cheese or something, you know, get a switchblade comb. I never got enough points to get this one prize, but I always eyed it. And every time we went into the room, and it was a board game called The Omega Virus. And I just had like my wildest fantasies were about how cool this game was, because it seemed like it involved a talking robot on the board. And I think the premise was like you're on a space station and an evil computer virus takes it over and you like go to spaces with your little figurine and you have to press the robot and it talks at you. It's like, you know, infection spreads and stuff. I can't be sure because I haven't played it, but I'm almost positive this game must be terrible, like not very fun, not very replayable. But I'm just sucked in by that fluff component, just this like machine that comes with it that you interact with. And I'm sure I would have been suckered in the same way by those horrible looking board games that have like VHS tapes that would accompany them, as has been documented on Everything is Terrible, like that Star Trek board game that has the guy who keeps saying experience beige.
Yeah. So you mentioned the fluff. Well, we should go ahead and describe this for everyone who may not be familiar. When we talk about board games and just gaming in general, generally there is a distinction between fluff and mechanics. Mm-hmm. And I would add that there is an additional part of this trifecta, that being materials.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, the pure mechanics of a game are just the rules of the game, how things move, how points are acquired, mm-hmm. and how a winner or winners is determined.
Right.
So, like, if someone's playtesting a game that they've developed, it may have very little or even no fluff. It could just be a system of numbers, a kind of game that would just totally not appeal to someone like me. Like I like a hefty dose of good fluff.
Well, yeah.
Fluff being the story, the characters, the setting. Like, oh, I'm moving pieces around on the board. What are they? Oh, it's a king and a queen and an army and some guys riding horses. Okay, now you're talking. Fluff.
An example of a game I think with no fluff is like Go.
Yeah.
It is just tiles with rules or not, pieces on a board with rules. And there's no imagery. There's no story. All that's gone. Maybe you could apply things like that to it. And maybe people have in some cases for all I know. But the bare game itself is the draw. It's just the mechanics. Then you've got all these other games. I think of like Candyland and The Game of Life, where really what's attractive about the game is like the illustrations on the board and the idea of what your character, the story of what your characters are doing as you, spin a wheel or roll dice and advance along spaces.
Yeah, so the fluff in Candyland is really good, but also the material. It has a neat looking board. Also, it wasn't Life the one that had the pop-o-matic bubble? That being a bit, maybe I'm thinking of another game.
I think you are. I think Life has a spinning wheel, like the Wheel of Fortune, It's Life. So,
well, there was some other game. I'm sure listeners will clue us in here, but had the pop-o-matic bubble. It had this material aspect of the game where you're like, that looks so fun. I just want to press that thing all day and play this game, even though it might suck. One example from my childhood, I remember being super bored with Monopoly. I hate Monopoly with a passion.
Cool.
But I do remember loving Fireball Island. Like that was this game, for anyone who hasn't played it or seen that it's actually been reissued. There was like a Kickstarter for it. It's this game with tremendous material and fluff features. It's like a 3D topographic island, and there is a monster head temple at the top of a volcano in the center that shoots out marbles at certain times in the game to knock your player back down the mountain.
Whoa.
And so it's just, it had a great ad campaign, but it was clear that the game itself is not that complicated and probably not that good. I haven't played it since I was a kid, mm-hmm. but clearly it was leaning very heavily on material and fluff.
But this makes board games an interesting thing to discuss in the context of invention, because board games are not the only thing we use that has appeal on both the material or not the both the mechanical side and the fluff side. I mean, lots of inventions, the success of them depends on both.
Right.
Some things become very popular because they are inherently very useful in their most basic functional sense, and other things become popular just because there's something aesthetically cool about them.
Oh yeah. Like another game that instantly comes to my mind is Space Hulk, mm-hmm. which was a game that I saw advertisements for as a kid, and I wanted just because the Warhammer 40,000 fluff to it was so good. It was like these space soldiers in armor fighting xenomorph-like aliens, the Tyranid gene stealers. And so I was instantly in. I was instantly sold by the fluff. The figurines looked great, so I was sold by the material. And later when I actually got to play it, it's a fine game as well. So all three of these things can line up. And when they do, you often have a game that stands the test of time. But the curious thing about time in board games is you can look at something like Monopoly, or you can look at a game like Space Hulk. And if you strip them down, there's nothing about this game that could not exist 30 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
because you're ultimately just moving pieces around. Like the fluff can change, it's just like, what is space? So it's people and monsters, and people have been battling monsters in human myth for since time out of mind. There's nothing about most of these games when you strip them down that can't exist in another age, but they didn't. There's still this evolution of the mechanics of games, the way we play games, and the sort of games we play.
Yes, that is really interesting. The way that, you know, it can seem like how did it take thousands of years for this game to be invented? But then again, almost all board games are, you could probably say, derivative of forms of other board games that previously existed. I mean, there are a few basic types. There's like the type where you try to reach a space on a board before everyone else does, mm-hmm. or the type where you try to accumulate the most of a certain type of token or, you know, money type currency. And then there's the kind where you have armies that battle each other until the other one is eliminated.
Right.
So while we keep coming up with new games that have never existed before, almost all the games we come up with are in some way – they've got ancestors in terms of their basic format and play style.
Absolutely. So you could take various modern games, take them back in time, and not only would even ancient people recognize it as a game – They might even be able to say, "Oh, well, that's kind of like this game that we play. It's kind of like it's a racing game or it's a fighting game, etc."
Of course, board games are not something that is found in nature. They are a product of human civilization, so they had to be invented at some point, and that's what we're going to be looking at today. What is a board game? What does it mean? How was it invented? And what role does it play for us? Now, before we explore the invention and the role of board games in human culture, we usually like to ask the question about an invention, what came before it, right? Mm-hmm. That helps you understand what it actually is. And so I was trying to think what came before the board game. It's not like, you know, there was a pre-board game that we know about. So it wasn't quite like that. But one thing we can be very sure of is that before we had board games, what do you do with a board game? You play it. So before we had board games, we had play.
That's right. If you look at a board game, or, you know, in this whole episode, you can also think a little outside of just board game and think of games that maybe don't actually involve a board or a play surface. What are they but kind of a simulation of something in reality with lower stakes, usually? And that's something that can exist even without some sort of physical apparatus or materials, right? And certainly that's something we see animals do as well.
Right. Well, I mean, we certainly don't see animals play board games. We do see them play.
Yeah. We see them, let's say, play fighting, where it's like they're fighting, but they're not really fighting. The stakes are not the same.
Right. And this is a really interesting psychological and biological question. It's interesting to me, but also there's a whole field of study around it, the study of play. What is play exactly? What is a game? It's one of those things, you know, it's in the pornography category. We know it when we see it, but mm-hmm. it's hard to set out a comprehensive definition of what exactly play is or what exactly a game is. In fact, the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein used the example of a game as his prime illustration of how not all useful categories can be bounded by a fixed set of universal characteristics. You know, this is one of his philosophical principles. Like, some concepts and categories instead operate on this principle that he called family resemblances. Quote, "a complicated network of similarities overlapping and crisscrossing." And to give a better example of this, I want to quote from a section of his book, Philosophical Investigations, that explains this thinking with a few abridgments. So Wittgenstein writes, quote, "Consider, for example, the proceedings that we call games. I mean board games, card games, ball games, Olympic games, and so on. What is common to them all? For if you look at them, you will not see something that is common to all, but similarities, relationships, and a whole series of them at that. Look, for example, at board games with their multifarious relationships. Now pass to card games. Here you find many correspondences with the first group, but many common features drop out and others appear. When we pass next to ball games, much that is common is retained, but much is lost. Are they all amusing? Compare chess with noughts and crosses. Or is there always winning and losing, or competition between players? Think of patience. In ball games, there is winning and losing, but when a child throws his ball at the wall and catches it again, this feature has disappeared. Look at the parts played by skill and luck, at the difference between skill in chess and skill in tennis. Think now of games like Ring-a-Ring-a-Roses. I think that's like Ring Around the Rosie. Here is the element of amusement, but how many other characteristic features have disappeared? And we can go through many, many other groups of games in the same way, can see how similarities crop up and disappear. And the result of this examination is we see a complicated network of similarities overlapping and crisscrossing, sometimes overall similarities, sometimes similarities of detail. And I've always thought that's a really interesting observation, that we have these categories. Game is one of them. Mm-hmm. I guess play would be another one, where we can identify it when we see it. We point out a thing and say, that's a game or that is play. But you can't put together a comprehensive definition that includes everything that is a game or everything that is play.
Right. Yeah. I love what he said here, because it makes me think, for instance, of something like bowling.
Yeah.
Like bowling is this activity that, yeah, certainly one can make an argument for game. One can make a strong argument for sport. And I think there are elements of the two. Like bowling to me feels like an activity where the world of sport and game converge,
uh-huh,
and perhaps cause a little bit of category confusion.
Wait, do I detect from this, are you staking out a position that sports are not games?
No, I'm saying that the distinction kind of falls in with what he's talking about here.
Oh, okay.
You know, like you look at the baseball game, you look at a game of Monopoly or cards, mm-hmm, and yeah, there are some things that line up about them, and yet there is a distinctive difference between the two.
Yeah, it can be really difficult because if Wittgenstein is right, we're faced with a problem in trying to, say, organize a scientific study of the idea of play or of games, because we want to understand what play is and what role it plays, what games are and what purpose they serve, but we have trouble creating like an airtight definition. There always seem to be some examples of things that just don't quite fit the definition you come up with, mm-hmm, but we would still look at those things and call them games or play. And yet, for the purposes of research, it's important to have clear definitions. So a lot of what these researchers do is just try to come up with a definition. And they can end up feeling kind of, I don't know what the word is, kind of multifarious and plodding as far as definitions go. Uh-huh. Like they've got a lot of clauses in them. But I want to read one I came across that I feel like is a pretty good biological definition of play. It might not get everything, but it's one of the best I've read. And it was set out by a University of Tennessee researcher named Gordon Burghardt in the American Journal of Play in 2010. And this is his definition. Quote, "Play is repeated behavior that is incompletely functional in the context or at the age in which it is performed and is initiated voluntarily when the animal or person is in a relaxed or low-stress setting." So that might be kind of hard to wrap your brain around, but I want to break out. It's got like five parts there.
Okay,
right?
Because already I'm thinking this applies to everything from hunting to
Well, no, that's the part. Okay. So first thing is that the behavior is not functional.
Okay.
It doesn't contribute to current survival. So hunting wouldn't count unless you're doing it recreationally.
And I feel like there are a lot of people who do it recreationally. There are a lot of people who certainly need to hunt to some degree,
right,
or certainly consume the food that they obtain through hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, continue.
Okay, so you might in that case class recreational hunting, in fact, as a form of play. Maybe it is.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's at least in the animals who need to hunt to survive, hunting is not play because hunting is functional. So play is not functional. Number two, it's done for its own sake. This is what we would call fun. It's intrinsically motivating, right?
Okay.
You don't have to do it for some other reason. It is itself attractive to you as an activity.
Right. You're not expecting to obtain food by it. You're not expecting to obtain a mate by it. You were doing it just for the love of the game.
Right. It pulls you in on its own power. Three, the behavior is different from normal survival behaviors in at least one respect. So something that is exactly the same as things you do for survival, even if you're not currently doing it for survival, that's probably not play, right? Play tends to, in Burghardt's words, quote, "it is incomplete generally through inhibited or dropped final elements." Think about the way like play fighting can like have the first parts of a fight there, but you don't actually go in for the kill or anything.
So gladiator competition, play in some cases.
Well, that might be something up for debate, yeah. But Burghardt also points out exaggerated, awkward, or precocious movements or behavior patterns with a modified form, sequencing, or targeting.
Okay.
So like attack behaviors against a thing that would not be normally a target of attack.
Okay.
Think about the way like a dog will play with a ball like it is a piece of prey. Mm-hmm. I don't think the dog actually thinks that the ball has meat in it. It's playing with the ball, right? But it does the same things to the ball broadly that it would do to, say, a rat that was in the house. Okay, that's the third thing. Fourth thing, behavior is repeated. You can do it more than once. And then fifth, it happens when stress is low. And this doesn't have to mean that there is no stress, but it just means it's not something that happens while you're currently like being chased by a predator.
Right.
And given this kind of definition, again, I think we can probably find ways that it might not perfectly fit what our intuitive ideas of play are. But I think that's a really good place to start. And that sort of helps us think about what the roles of play and games might be for biological organisms like us.
All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
And we're back.
One of the things, of course, we mentioned earlier is that we know play predates things like board games because play is present in non-human animals. I mean, it's there in there are actually debates over how many animals it's present in. Like, for example, it's extremely common among mammals. It seems almost universal among mammals. Like, people have generally seen the way dogs will chase and wrestle each other, the way kittens stalk and pounce on each other and engage in various forms of play fighting. Cats are, I think, sometimes even more playful than people give them credit for.
Oh, yeah, especially the indoor variety that are cut off from their natural world and, of course, you know, partially insane because of what we've done to them. They're kind of in that permanent state of kittenhood. For instance, my cat stalks and attacks my feet pretty much every day, but does not seem to be doing it with intent to maim and consume my feet.
No, I mean, I would guess that that's probably play. It is done intrinsically for the fun of doing it.
Right. For her. It's not – I don't find it tremendously fun myself, but she loves it. She can't get enough of it.
Well, why can't your feet take a joke?
It's more the claws and the teeth than the joke. I'm all up for the joke.
So, we know this is there in these – I guess we consider them, since they're predatory mammals, we think about them as having like more complex brains. But it's also there in, say, mice. Like I was reading an article by the researchers Lee Allen Dugatkin and Serena Rodriguez for a Berkeley publication. And they were pointing out that research has found that mice usually start playing about 15 days after they're born and that play activities peak around 19 to 25 days. And this seems to coincide with neuroscience has revealed, coincide with development of synapses in the cerebellum. And those synapses are necessary for muscle control in life. So there seems to be something going on where like young mice are playing around the same time their brains are developing the stuff that they need for running around and surviving with muscle control. And also mice tend to show greater brain development when they're raised in environments with wheels and other play structures than in environments without them. Give mice something to play with and their brains do better.
So this is the basic idea that of play as a rehearsal for something. Play as practice for skills one will need as an adult.
Yes, or play being necessary for just normal brain development. And both of those are strong theories about why play exists in the animal world, though we'll come back to that in some caveats in just a minute. An interesting question I came across is there play among non-mammals? We know it's pretty much universal among mammals, but there are all these debatable reports of play among various birds and reptiles. It does seem, for example, that ravens play. They do stuff that's hard not to look at and say, that's play. Like juvenile ravens are attracted to novel objects almost in the way, like a dog would be with toys.
Right.
And they seem to play around with them. One really interesting thing I came across was in 2015, the zoologist Vladimir Donets published a paper in Animal Behavior and Cognition describing the play behaviors of crocodilians.
Oh, wow.
Playful crocodiles, which apparently was not news to people who worked regularly with these animals. But you might be wondering, well, how the heck does a crocodile play or an alligator, you know, what does that look like? There are all kinds of ways. Sometimes they chase after inflatable balls. They surf in waves. They snap at flowing water. They give each other piggyback rides. They blow bubbles. These are all things that seem to meet these biological and ethological definitions of play.
That's crazy because I would certainly have thought, okay, the raven might play. It is an intelligent creature.
But reptiles?
But reptiles, yeah.
I would have been there with you. But apparently this is just common knowledge to people who work hands-on with crocodilians a lot. Even fish, there is debate about this, about whether this really counts as play. But for example, they sometimes jump when there's no need to, when stress levels are low. Why? There's nothing chasing them. They're not getting anything from it. We've talked about fish jumping on stuff to blow your mind before.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on that. Yeah.
And so there are some ideas that maybe they're playing. Maybe this is a form of play. Now, once you get down to invertebrates, it really does get much trickier to find things that could reasonably be classed as play, except, of course, in the case of, you know what, cephalopods, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I was thinking about insects, and I was thinking, oh, well, Dr. Seth Brundle told us that there are no insect politics.
Right.
And he didn't say anything about play, but it kind of stands to reason that insects would not play. But then, of course, I forget about the invertebrate superstars of the cephalopod world.
Yeah, which are, you know, the true aliens on Earth. Like, octopuses are clearly one of the most playful animals on this planet. Though their play might seem very strange to us, they seem to enjoy puzzles and new toys and challenges. And sometimes they, like, pull on people in what seem to be strange examples of social play. There are also even reports of play-like behaviors among insects like ants and wasps, but these reports, this is very controversial.
Well, I guess a lot of this is getting into an individual organism's tendencies towards neophilia, the likelihood that they're going to seek out novel experiences or items. If they are, you know, a curious creature that benefits, has a survival benefit in trying things out, such as we've talked about raccoons on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before.
Oh, yeah. Of course, raccoons being mammals do seem to be somewhat playful, but also we talked about the idea that, like, raccoons who have stronger neophilia instincts, the mm-hmm. ones that seek out novel objects and approach them rather than avoid them, they tend to do better in, say, urban environments,
right.
Which that makes sense. You approach some novel objects in an urban environment, you'll often get some fries out of it or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I want to come back and kind of rope in just a basic overview of the ideas about why play exists in animals. What biological purpose does it serve? Of course, this is something we don't fully know the answer to, right? This is an unsolved question, but there are some strong hypotheses with some evidence behind them. So one we already mentioned is that play is training for crucial survival or reproductive skills. And in the words of the English psychologist Peter K. Smith, this would mean, quote, play primarily affords juveniles practice toward the exercise of later skills. And you can already probably imagine tons of reasons for thinking this is the case. Like, think about how much of the play we see in other animals and in humans, frankly, resembles forms of survival and reproduction behavior. Play very often looks like fighting, hunting, escaping, feeding, or mating. Actions that, you know, mimic these activities in an exaggerated or incomplete form make up a huge portion of play behaviors. But there are also there's some evidence against this too. There are studies in many animals, including some types of mice and meerkats, that have found that animals who play at a skill like hunting or fighting do not later show advantages at this skill compared to individuals that play at the skill less. So maybe sometimes this isn't the case. There's also the question of why forms of play sometimes continue into adulthood after survival skills are mastered, or why some play behaviors, especially in humans, do not mimic physical survival behaviors. A classic example of this would be the board game.
Oh, yes.
A couple of alternate theories I came across because they were mentioned by Dugatkin and Rodriguez. One is that play is essentially for, like, social species. It's for learning the rules. This is from the University of Colorado biologist Mark Bakoff, and he basically says that play is useful for developing a sense of morality and social skills. Like, play allows animals to experience and internalize their social clan's sense of fairness, of inclusion and exclusion, of justice, and what cheating is.
Oh, yeah. This is a good point. Something that I see coming up in my own life with a 6-year-old, playing some board games with him while he's also learning how to play chess at school. And a lot of it is, you know, certainly we're stressing abstract thought and learning systems of rules and strategy. But a lot of it is like learning how to lose, learning how to win, how to do both of those things gracefully, how not to cheat, how to respond to cheating. Like, these are all sort of aspects of the general exercise.
Yeah, so I think that that's a strong possibility as well. Another theory is from the Czech researcher Marek Špinka, who says that play is to help animals not necessarily just practice individual skills like hunting, fighting, and all that, but to generally prepare for the unexpected. It's how an animal readies its brain to be surprised by life and deal with that surprise gracefully.
Huh.
So things like being knocked off balance when you're not expecting it, or things like encountering failure in a chase or something like this. Another way of putting this is that play and games serve to increase versatility.
This is a very good point, because I'm thinking about like various physical sports. A lot of it does seem to have it seemed to stress bodily awareness and being able to react physically to change. And then most board games of any note, you know, there's some level of you go into the game with a certain strategy.
Yeah.
There's a certain way you can and perhaps will win.
Uh-huh.
But then the best laid plans, right?
You're foiled.
You have to figure out, well, how am I going to react to this and still try and achieve my initial goals? Maybe there's a different way I'm going to have to win after all.
Well, and this, you can see it in the way that we have an extremely derisive attitude toward people who do not lose or face adversity in games well. You know,
yeah.
The person who flips the table when they get when they, you know, get frustrated in Risk or something, that's
right.
Like an archetype we all know about. We all know that guy, and that behavior is strongly frowned upon.
Right. Now, part of it might be because they're playing Monopoly or some garbage game like that. But the people who react like that to games, they can probably react like that to just about any game. And I think one of the important lessons of gaming, like one that I continually try to embrace, is in enjoying the way in which you lose.
Yes.
Like I think it's a testament too of a well-designed game, because I've also played some games where I'm like, okay, this game is kind of BS and I'm losing. There's really what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but a really good game, you're like, oh, I see disaster is coming, and isn't it interesting how it's playing out? What can I do to minimize disaster? That can sometimes become the new game that you're playing.
That is a really great kind of game. I hadn't even thought about that. Games that are interesting to lose.
Yeah.
So one more theory I want to mention before we move on. The last one I came across was in a presentation called What is Play For? By the Penn State professor Gary Chick. And this discusses the possibility that play is favored by sexual selection, that it's playfulness is a signaling mechanism of fitness in adults. And that might answer why even adults are playful and not just children. Like animals, including humans, tend to prefer mates that play, because play is interpreted as a signal of a few things. Play signals youthfulness. Play signals good health. Play signals intelligence, and it signals good socialization.
Yeah, these are all solid points. But plus, in the more the human context, there's a sense of leisure there, right? Like
yeah.
This individual has space in their life for something of little or no consequence, like a game.
Right. I mean, in the animal context, I think that's part of the good health signaling, right? If you show off that you can play a game, you're showing off that you're not starving and sick and at the edge.
Yeah, like, hey, look, I'm chasing a ball. This isn't going to feed me, but I'm big enough. I can catch something later.
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, we don't know which of these theories are correct. And there are other ones, too. We don't have time to chase them all down here. I guess you could also posit that, of course, play is not for anything, that it doesn't serve any adaptive biological purpose. But given how widely play is selected for, I really find this unlikely. But anyway, to come back to board games here, given all of this we've looked at, I think one of the interesting questions to ask is, what kind of play does a board game represent, and how does a board game fit into this whole model? So if you take the view that, well, maybe a lot of play is training for skills later in life, maybe that's what most of play is for in the animal world, that's obviously plausible for a lot of different things because, as we mentioned earlier, how many types of play involve things that are necessary for survival, like chasing, fighting, playing house, imaginative playing with skills of, you know, maintaining a domestic life, that kind of thing.
Right. Finding your mystery date, creating your, you know, ensuring your financial future, battling barbarians.
Right.
Or simply just responding to luck, responding to chance, responding to unforeseen events.
Well, I think that last one might be especially relevant with games, with board games, because what sets board games apart from so many of these other games, like play fighting, play chasing, playing house, and all that, is that unlike these physical sports and stuff, board games become almost entirely abstracted from any physical activity that is important for survival or reproduction. They're abstract games. They're games taken into an imaginary space that you don't act out full behaviors with your body, you know?
Right. Yeah. It becomes, even though you may have some impressive fluff, you may have some impressive materials, some very nice figurines, etc. It's still largely something that is taking place in the mind,
yeah,
with the aid of some physical materials and, of course, a system of rules.
With that in mind, I think we should maybe take a break and then come back and focus on some of the earliest known board games and see what we can make of them.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me!
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So in researching this, we looked to a number of different sources, but of course I ended up picking up Brian M. Fagan's excellent The 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World as a fun starting place.
Uh-huh.
He only devotes 2 pages to board games, but it provides a nice overview. And one of the things that he drives home is that board games are probably as old as human culture, that pretty much any ancient or modern society has some sort of board game. Mm-hmm. It just seems innately tied to how we think and how we use objects and rules. And you could even go so as far as to say that they're a defining element of human society.
Hmm.
Now, obviously, they came out of something, though, right? But the details are lost to the mists of history. It's unlikely that there's a single necessity or breakthrough that evolved into game playing, but there are a couple of key theories that I think are worth considering.
Okay.
So the first is that, and this ties in with some of the discussions we've had about play, is that it is the safe sublimation of competition and rivalry.
Oh, this is often a theory about sports as well.
Right.
That it does something to it takes an instinct that we have that can be destructive and gives us an outlet for that instinct that is not destructive.
Right. You know, today we have a game night in which, say, fellow employees or friends or family members will gather together and attempt to crush each other so that one may rise up victorious over the rest.
Yeah.
This would be terrible if we did this for realsies. But since we're doing it within the confines of a board game or card game or what have you, it's perfectly acceptable. It's even beneficial.
Well, I mean, look at the way people practice sports fandom. You can clearly see in this that we have some powerful instincts that that cause us to want to band together in groups in support of, you know, against a common enemy that's also banding together. We have, I think, some inherent warlike instincts. And I think it would probably be bad if we just had these instincts bouncing around without any way to express them that wasn't actually harmful.
But generally speaking, you're dealing with far lower stakes.
Yes.
Even if there is money on the line, it is still generally your life is not on the line.
Right.
Now, the second idea, and this one I really find interesting, is that board games emerged out of ritual and divination practices.
Yes, 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 yes. This is really interesting. Now, of course, divination practices would be what? It would be trying to answer an unanswerable question or gain some piece of knowledge by the invocation of the gods or spirits or something, usually using a physical medium.
Yeah, and sometimes it's overt. It is, say, asking a spirit, a deceased loved one or an ancestor or a god or a goddess or a supernatural entity for help.
Mm-hmm.
Other times it's a bit more obscure, like what you're actually asking and why you're using a particular means to do so.
We had an episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind where we talked about the I Ching, where we get into a lot of this.
Yeah, talking about the I Ching is essentially a randomization engine for divination that depends on physical objects to create and record randomized events. Specifically, tossing a few coins, laying some sticks down to keep track of what the coins tell you, and then referring to a system of rules to tell you what these lines mean.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, how you should act, what you should expect based on that.
Now, I remember in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode, we talked about how even though, you know, we're not positing that sortilege methods where you like, you know, cast lots or something are actually giving you, say, knowledge of the future or anything mm-hmm. like that, they could still be useful or adaptive in that they might tend to prompt action when you are otherwise frozen. Like it's possible, you know, you're just faced with a problem, you don't know what to do. And in fact, it's the case that really any action is better than no action, and thus consulting a divination method gives you impetus to go forward with some type of response.
I remember in that I Ching episode that we did, we looked to a quote from Julian Jaynes,
mm-hmm.
who is the individual that was behind the bicameral mind hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular quote has little to do with that particular hypothesis. But he was talking about sortilege,
mm-hmm.
and he said, quote, "But this simplicity, even a triviality to us, should not blind us from seeing the profound psychological problem involved, as well as appreciating its remarkable historical importance. We are so used to the huge variety of games of chance, of throwing dice, roulette wheels, etc., all of them vestiges of this ancient practice of divination by lots, that we find it difficult to really appreciate the significance of this practice historically. It is a help here to realize that there was no concept of chance, whatever, until very recent times." So, to think about and he's tying that in a little bit to his hypothesis, but for the most part, yeah, thinking of the primordial ancestors to the board game, mm-hmm. to games of chance, being simply a way of figuring out how to act. I must do something, but how do I possibly weigh these two things? I must appeal to some other force.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that. We can't know this for sure, that, mm-hmm. Ancient or prehistoric peoples had no concept of chance. But judging by their writings, when we have access to those, it does seem like they didn't really have much of an idea of randomness. At least to me, it seems more like there's a general belief in sort of like determinism by the gods or by some kind of power of fate.
Right.
That when something that appears random happens, say even just the outcome of a dice roll, that was the will of the gods for it to happen that way. And so if you imagine board games in this context, they would take on a very different cast, right?
Uh-huh.
Every time you throw the dice, which I guess at that time probably wouldn't have been dice, but would have been something like, sticks that fall in a certain way to tell you how many places to move or what the outcome of something is, or knuckle bones are a common one.
Rattle those bones.
Yeah, rattle the bones. I think there's this old Babylonian inscription that's like a gambler's lament that says like, woe, woe, woe to me, the knuckle bones. That's like, oh no, that, they gave me bad fate. But the bad fate could be within a game. And within the game, this would still be interpreted perhaps as a deliverance by the gods or a punishment by the gods. Like the gods are determining who wins your dice game.
Yeah. It's kind of like you're going, all right, God, I need some help on this. Give me a sign. All right. I don't see a sign. What I'm going to do is I'm going to throw this stick. And if it lands this way, I'm going to assume that's a yes.
Uh-huh.
And if it lands the other way, I'm going to take that as a no. So balls in your court, God. Here we go.
But what if it's not a yes or a no about a question in your life, but about do I get to advance a space in this game on the board?
Wow. Imagine if that was the case. Every time we play a board game, a divine being has to like clock in for the day. Like, oh my goodness, they're playing Arkham Horror. I'm going to be here all night. Oh, I hate this one. Can't they just play checkers?
Uh-huh. I wonder if this may come in as – one of the things I often wonder about is like why do some religions forbid games of chance or forbid gambling? What is it about that activity that makes it detestable to the religious authorities and the people who come up with these religious dogmas? I wonder if games of chance, especially in the ancient frame of mind, tend to suggest a belief in like consulting demons and a non-sanctioned spiritual authorities, so that when you roll a die or roll a knuckle bone, you may in fact be having a consult every time you do it with some kind of illicit spirit, with a demon or something.
Huh. And it would be interesting to come back and do an invention episode on gambling. But I also wonder, and I may be completely off on this, I wonder if it's ever a case where, okay, if a board game or a game is simply a simulation, a simplification with lowered stakes, if you then raise the stakes again, does that become gambling? And because that's kind of how I always think about gambling. It's like playing cards for fun. That's fun.
Mm.
Playing cards for money. Okay, you've taken something fun and you've made it a little dirty and you've made losing feel more real. And you've made winning a little more icky somehow. Everyone's mileage is going to vary on that.
Well,
but that's my take on it.
I think there could also be, when you're talking about not just games of chance, but like adding the gambling element.
Yes, yeah.
Which does seem to be often crucial, is there money on the line? There, you could also just say that it's like, well, it's a basic social control problem because for some reason where there's gambling, there also tends to be disorder and crime. Mm-hmm. Gambling tends to lead to fights and murder and stuff. It could just be something like as simple as that.
Right. I know we were looking at some sources about Islamic law and the interpretation of Islamic laws concerning games of chance,
mm-hmm.
versus games of skill. And it seems like for the most part, based on what we're looking at, generally gambling is bad. Gambling is against the rules. But games that have dice in them, if they're games of skill, is generally okay. So specifically, Dungeons and Dragons is fine.
Well, I think there's a difference opinion among different Muslim scholars.
Yes, you're still going to find some individuals that have, you know, they're a lot stricter on this and stricter on the interpretation and would say that, no, if there are dice involved or there's some sort of chance element, then it is not permitted.
You know, going back to the sort of adaptive or evolutionary framework, I wonder if you can fundamentally class games of chance versus games of skill as having different kinds of roles in our biology and our psychology.
Yeah, yeah, probably so. And maybe that's, again, one of the reasons that it's so perfect when those two things are balanced in a single game, mm-hmm. where you do need skill to win, and yet there are these unpredictable moments, these turning points that can totally change the outcome, and no amount of skill. Like, maybe skill will be essential to survive those twists and turns.
Yeah, well, I mean, dealing with unforeseen circumstances is a skill in a way.
Yeah.
The skill of versatility is the ability to face the vicissitudes of fate and come up with a way around.
Like, Candyland is definitely a game that requires no skill.
Right.
You know, if anybody who's ever played it with a child knows, it's just all random movement. There's not really any – there are no decisions to be made. You're the complete whims of the universe, mm-hmm. when it comes to that. That's going to be the one the gods really hate clocking in for, because they have to do all the work. But then you have games like chess, right, where, yes, you're having to respond to changes that are perpetrated, but they're perpetrated by your opponent.
Right.
At any rate, I do want to drive home that whether we're looking at this idea of games and board games as the safe sublimation of competition or as something that emerged out of divination practices, we can't really know for sure. There's evidence for both of these. There are likely other reasons in play as well, including just the desire to do something that amuses you, something that is fun.
But I'm still haunted by that question. How did the thing that amuses us, the thing that's fun, become moving around little tiles on top of a patterned surface or like rolling a knuckle bone and seeing how many of a piece of tokens we got to take or something? It's such a strange and abstract way of approaching games, which in their core, they should involve the body, right? They should mm-hmm. involve, like, you should be playing house, or you should be play fighting, you should be running a race, but instead we're doing it in this abstract space with these little representative figurines. I mean, it almost seems like it suggests to me that there could be some kind of relationship between the emergence of board games as this abstracted form of play and the emergence of writing as this abstracted form of representing thoughts, this abstracted form of speech.
Yeah, taking what's going on inside our minds and put in externalizing it. Mm-hmm. Because think of one of the key things that our mind does is we're simulating future events. We're engaging in mental time travel, both past and future. We're trying mm-hmm. to envision what is going to happen and how we're going to react to stuff like that happening. And it's a purely mental exercise. Mm-hmm. So it's, in a sense, planning it all out or doing just very abstract versions of planning it all out in a physical system, in a board game, like that's perfectly in keeping with the spirit of play fighting, but it's a different type of fight. It's the kind of fight that really only conscious beings are capable of engaging in.
This is really interesting, and that's why I am so excited to come back next time and talk about the earliest known evidence of board games. What do the earliest board games look like? What are they?
That's right. There's some fascinating examples to run through, but we've run the full course for this episode. So in the meantime, as you're waiting for next week's episode to come out, head on over to inventionpod.com. That is the mothership for this show. That's where you'll find all the episodes of Invention, links out to some social media accounts, a link to a store even if you really like our jazzy logo and would like to get it on a sticker or a shirt. That's a fun way to support the show, but really the best thing you can do to support Invention and ensure that we get to keep rolling these episodes out is to make sure you have subscribed. And once you've subscribed to Invention, make sure you give us a nice rating wherever you have the ability to do so. Throw up some stars, throw up a nice review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback about this episode or any other episode, to suggest a topic for a future episode of Invention, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.